So when we talk about language justice, this is what we mean is a commitment to center people's languages and culture and decentering English as a dominant language.
Welcome to SHS Radio.
I'm Grace.
I'm Cam.
And I'm Hema, and we're your hosts for today.
We are second year students at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine.
We're also in Dr. Corby Smith's class on health disparities in the time of COVID-19. And for today's podcast, we wanted to talk about the issue of language justice and interpreter services and how healthcare is delivered to patients who don't speak English as their first language.
Today we're going to be talking to three community members. We're going to start off with Dr. Aleman, who is an internal medicine doctor at UNC, and he's also the director of the COMPOST program.
We also interviewed a patient who, you know, experienced a lot of the consequences of not being able to communicate the same language with his providers. His name is Mr. Murillo. He is a Spanish speaker from Durham, North Carolina, and he shares with us his experience having COVID in June of 2020.
Yeah, and then I sat down with two members of RCP, Refugee Community Partnership, which is a nonprofit organization in Carrboro, North Carolina, that works with refugee and immigrant communities to offer social support and navigation through the healthcare system. Yeah, in our state of North Carolina, regarding COVID, we saw that while Latino communities make up under 10% of the state's population, they made up almost 30% of the state's COVID cases. And when you compare cases per 100,000 people in the white population of North Carolina, it was 6,000, while the Hispanic Latino community was over 12,000 cases. You know, when you adjust for the population, there's twice the rate of infection in that community. So quite a drastic disparity. Is language justice an issue of racial justice?
Yes, I would definitely say yes, because these incidents are resulting in tangible harm that we see in patients, in inequality in care. Ultimately, it is a form of discrimination when patients are effectively unable to receive the same quality of care as English-speaking patients. The majority of limited English proficiency communities do identify as people of color, and so this is creating additional disparities in addition to the ones that we know that exist outside of language. And often these are compounded. So these are communities that are already experiencing discrimination because of the color of their skin, because of their ethnic background. And we're adding on top of that now language as well. So it really compounds.
Yeah. Let's dig more into the language service. So when a patient has a doctor's appointment, they call to get that appointment done. That appointment scheduled. They check in. They have to have their vitals. They check their temperature, weight, and all that. And then they will see the physician. And there's also post appointments. Do they have a referral? Do they have to go to the pharmacies? So most of the time, when an interpreter is provided, is only provided when a physician is in the room. But the appointment, we all know that the appointment does not start there. The appointment starts way before the physician comes in. The appointment does not end when the physician leaves the room, but the appointments end when that patient probably is feeling better. Because even if we are sent home, we know, and you're not feeling good, you always call, you want to be called, you want to have access to your physician. For those of us who have something like my chart, we send a message to our physician, we communicate. But that communication is not there for people who don't speak English. So when you have an interpreter just when the doctors come in, you can tell that there's so much that you're missing. I don't know how much confidence you have by the time the doctor is in the room after they've checked your vital without communicating with you, after you've probably signed some few papers without an interpreter or a translator. There's just so much that goes into an appointment prior to that interpreter being available. And a lot of the time, again, like I mentioned, a lot of patients come from countries where the health system is different. There's some patient who might have a referral, and that will be the first time they've heard about referral. A lot of the time when you have a referral, that office has to call you. I'm saying all this not just to say these words, but I want us to think about it and put ourselves in the shoe of our patient.
We've learned a lot from both of you about language justice, how imperative it is for proper healthcare, and just how many places it can break down. Given the current situation, I was wondering if you could share some insight into how COVID has either brought some of these issues to light or further exacerbated the disparities that we've talked about.
Yeah, so I certainly think that COVID has exacerbated the issue. I think in some regards, it put a spotlight on the issue. We were hearing from local clinics and from hospitals that they were just not able to contact their patients. And that really highlighted that the way patients were getting care before was to physically show up somewhere. And so now during COVID, when patients are being turned away, they're not able to physically show up, they're forced to call. And that's highlighting the fact that if you call pretty much any hospital or clinic, I can almost guarantee that there is not a clear way, except for Spanish, but there's not a clear way to get communication across if you're calling and you don't speak English. And even for Spanish, folks call and there's a line for Spanish, but maybe there's one person that answers that line and you have to wait on hold for 2 hours to get to someone. So that lack of being able to just show up in person was making it clear to clinics that they were unable to meet the language needs of their patients. I think also COVID made there be less community protection or buffer for patients, because previously family members would take up the duty of accompanying someone in their family who spoke less English than them as kind of a safety mechanism to ensure that that family member, that patient, is able to communicate with the providers, is able to understand and make informed decisions.
I think Megan, her comment on having a family member or the role of a family member as a safety net segues great to our patient story, which is about a gentleman in our community who speaks primarily Spanish and went to the emergency room when he was sick with COVID-19 seeking care.
Can you tell us a little about that photo?
¿Cuándo fue eso? ¿Dónde fue de?
Eso fue el 23 de junio del año pasado, del 2020, que yo ingresé al hospital.
How long were you in the hospital for?
Por 23 días. Wow. 23 días yo estuve hospitalizado.
So here, Mr. Murillo is telling us a little bit about a photo that was taken. It's a photo of him in his family dining room with a cake celebrating his return.
And what was it like when you arrived at the hospital?
La verdad fue una de mis peores experiencias que yo he tenido en mi vida, porque cuando yo llegué, me atendieron hasta como a las 2 horas de estar ahí sentado. Lógicamente ya mi estado estaba más relajado y yo en ese momento el porcentaje de oxidación era 93%. Uh-huh. Y ella no me quiso ingresar. Uh-huh. No me quiso ingresar. Ella me mandaba para la casa.
To tell you the truth, it was one of the worst experiences I've had in my life. When I arrived, I wasn't attended to until after about 2 hours of waiting. Of course, I was much more relaxed at that point. My O2 stat was 93%, and she did not want to admit me. She wanted to send me home.
Llegó un momento que yo incluso se me salían las lágrimas, tratando de explicarle a ella que yo estaba mal, que yo no podía respirar, porque yo solo tenía el 50% de un pulmón, lo demás estaba parado. Entonces yo se me salían las lágrimas tratando de explicarle a ella que yo estaba mal, y ella me decía que no, y que no, y que no. Me preguntó quién era mi contacto, le di el número de teléfono de Kenny, mi nombre, y lo llamó. Y yo solo alcancé a escuchar que Kenny le dijo que no me iba a ir a traer, que yo me les iba a morir allí adentro, y que él los iba a demandar después, porque él sabía perfectamente que yo estaba mal.
Tears started to swell in my eyes at one point as I tried to explain to her that I was unwell, that I could not breathe because I had only 50% of one lung left that was working. In tears, I kept explaining that I was unwell, and she repeatedly responded with no. She asked me for a contact, and I gave her Kenny's name and number, whom she called. All I was able to hear was Kenny telling her no, that he was not going to come get me, that I was going to die under their supervision, and he was going to sue them, because he knew that I was ill.
How does it feel now, like a year and a half later, reflecting back on the story and the things that happened? You know, do you feel that the doctors and the people at the emergency room communicated with you in a way that was fair?
Pues yo lo que siento es al recordar todo lo que yo viví, me da tristeza, me da impotencia y me da lástima pues por la gente que no... Los que no hablamos inglés, y gracias a Dios yo tenía quien hablara inglés por mí. Mm-hmm. Pero mucha gente no tiene a nadie que pueda hablar por él. Y yo sé que mucha gente, incluso gente que ha muerto, yo pienso que las mandaron para su casa y pudiendo atenderlos y no hubo nadie que hablara por ellos.
Remembering all that I went through, I feel sadness, helplessness. I feel sorry for those of us who don't speak English. Thank God I had someone to advocate for me. But a lot of people don't have anyone to speak for them. And I know that a lot of people, including those who have already died, were sent home when they could have been cared for because there was no one to advocate for them.
Wow. That's a powerful story. You can really hear the emotion in his voice as he recalls those events from last year. I think it's really a tragic example of how our healthcare system and our existing interpretation infrastructure fails patients who don't speak English. And unfortunately, it's quite common. It's, you know, it's not relegated to a specific language or racial or ethnic group. It's most limited English proficiency patients will have, you know, similar stories. I think this is a really good transition, actually, to our conversation with Dr. Aleman and Refugee Community Partnership about interpretation services.
How did you and other physicians kind of go about navigating having less interpreters and having more or the same amount of patients come through?
So what I do and other physicians do is we have a phone and also interpreters by iPad that UNC Hospitals provides for us. Interpreter, so they're pretty busy.
Yeah.
And even before COVID, they were longer wait. If you have a person who needs interpretation in the office or in the hospital, I imagine it's much challenging. Mm-hmm. Because usually there's one person in our entire building. There are also issues where patients may not know how to use the technology or have the technology. Mm-hmm. Some patients may not have an iPad, might have a computer. They're using their cell phone as their method of accessing telehealth. And sometimes they have challenges in accessing that information. I have many patients who... the nurses or the schedulers list them for a telehealth video visit, which would be nice to see their face and talk to them. And mm-hmm. Unfortunately, many times we have to turn it into a telephone visit because they can't receive the link, they don't know how to open it, and there's a lot of time spent trying to talk to them through this, and it just slows the process down. Because of the pandemic, we don't have the... back then, we didn't have the support we normally would have with the Latino clinic, mm-hmm. and because everyone was in quarantine. So that was made it more challenging that we didn't have a person who would normally help that person with their phone present, mm-hmm. have them log in and show them how to use my chart, how to use all these other telehealth visit connections.
Yeah, and I can imagine with the technical difficulties, it was mostly the older patients, correct? That
had unfortunately. Us were a little bit older, just a little slower.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, if you have a younger member of the family who's available, they have access to, they can easily help them navigate. Mm-hmm. Which is not so. Sometimes I have my older Latinas you could tell is their granddaughter or someone writing yes. in the My Chart, connecting with me.
So let me ask a follow-up to that. Do you see differences at all with in-person versus telephonic or virtual interpretation?
Yes, there's definitely a difference between in-person versus telephonic. We've had instances where community members will talk about having trouble hearing a telephonic interpreter. There's just some appointment where having a telephonic interpreter is very hard.
Do you see these issues with both in-person interpretation and telephonic virtual interpretation, or is it more or less relegated to one of those two methods?
That's a great question. Issues, it's there in both, and we can explain this. Maybe my colleague will talk more about just the language service in general, but there's definitely a huge difference between telephonic interpretation and in-person interpretation. For instance, a woman in labor, when they have contraction and they have to sign some consent form, for example, because they want an epidural, in that moment, it's really hard for them to be thinking straight. And then once you bring a telephonic interpreter, it's really hard for them to communicate and to just grasp all that. There's provider around them, there's nurses around them, and then there's also a phone that they need to respond to. That's just too much for a patient. So for some instances, there is a need to have in-person interpretation.
I think the biggest issue is it's hard to really connect or feel that you really connected with the patient as I'd like to be. It's if you use an interpreter, whether it's in person or if it's a computer, that warm and back and forth you do with the patient to make him feel comfortable.
The small chit chat,
the little things you do, and because you don't know the culture, you don't know if you need to do the certain touch or do certain things. I think those are the things that I find very challenging. And so I always wonder if the connection is as strong as I would normally be with my other patients who speak English or Spanish. I also say that it's humbling and it's important to work with interpreters because when I work with interpreters for these other populations who speak other languages, I see the challenges that are interfaced with using interpreters because you can't have just a free-flowing conversation. And I also see what we all teach, be careful if your patient says a bunch of stuff and the interpretation is just very short.
Yes.
and you have to know, and I've learned, to say, please say everything the patient said, because there's a filter, if the interpreter is a filter, that's a hard portion. I'd like to know exactly what the patient said so that I can ask questions that are follow-up questions that are appropriate. I think we lose a lot. I'm sure it's been written up in language interactions when someone decides what should and should not be. And I know I've read some articles about this, even just in Spanish.
Yeah.
And I think that the barrier that creates, very palpable when I've used either interpreters or other venues.
We're really interested in reshaping what interpreter services look like and acknowledging that the way things are working now, they're not working and something needs to change.
Another model that we can add is a language navigator, not necessarily a health navigator, but a language navigator. That's something that we've tried with our own organization, but having someone who is there for the patient so that a patient can communicate really their needs, and also someone who has the culture background, because as a lot of these health institutions are there to support their community, and part of that community is also the non-speaking members, so we also need to see them, because a lot of the time institutions are set up and the way they were built, they stay like that even when the community that they're serving has changed. So we need to start reflecting our community by the services that are provided with the institutions. So that's something that we are encouraging clinics and hospitals to start thinking about, to be reflective of the community that they're serving, because there is a community. There's so many communities out there that are suffering for a lack of communication, which in this day and age should not happen.
I know you're the director of the Campus program, and one of the main goals is to kind of fill these gaps. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Campus likes to create bilingual providers as our bicultural providers who can work with the Spanish-speaking population. And our goal is that most of those students who become physicians would do it without interpreters. We realize not everyone can, but at least you would know your limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that with Campus, we're trying to build, improve the workforce that can do this. And our hope is that by doing that, we help not only with individual patients, but also we're seeing that with Campus, people are going into areas where they have leadership positions that can influence the system. We're seeing that in many, many areas, both at UNC and outside UNC, as well as, you know, they're like seeds. Seeds go everywhere.
Through some of the interviews and stuff, we talked like a little bit about like actionable items and like initiatives and things that were like happening, because there are like ways to help overcome these problems, but it's not as, I guess, embraced and global as you would hope. But different institutions are like doing different things to try to like navigate these issues. Like RCP has like their navigator program, where they have people who speak that language and are from that culture accompanying patients to the appointments, and they don't step in, they don't interpret or anything unless they need to.
I think also another intervention that Dr. Lamont mentioned was how there's issues with patients before even they can get into the clinic communicating with their physician on like, what's that? It's my chart. Like it's all in English, all the interfaces are in English. You know, if you don't have someone there who can read or even be tech savvy, you're not gonna be able to log in. So he said there's a committee starting at UNC who's looking at kind of developing multi-language options for the MyChart interface.
This issue of MyChart reminds me a lot about a RADx project out of the University of Utah. This project is called Scale Up, and they are using text messaging to reach patients who do not speak English. So in their population, it's majority Spanish speakers. And in terms of demographic, they're often low SES and historically underserved. So this text messaging allows for patient navigators or community healthcare workers to serve as an intermediary and disseminate accurate information about COVID-19 screening, testing, and vaccinations in an effort to really reduce the disparity we see in this population. Another thing I'm reminded of is the intervention that RCP was talking about, where interpreters would be able to make their own rounds.
I love that.
So in a hospital, as an example, they would have a list of all of the patients who spoke their language, and they would go make their rounds kind of asking how the patient is doing, if there's any questions they have or anyone specifically they want to communicate with on the healthcare team. And something I thought was so cool about this project is that it really allows for shared decision-making in instances where, you know, the patient and the provider don't share the same language. And I think with our current interpreter model, that's really hard to do.
It is incredibly hard to do. Here's some specific advice our guests had for healthcare workers when working with patients who speak a different language.
Just because they don't speak the same language, it doesn't mean that they don't care about the same things. Mm-hmm. And also the cultural component comes very much into play, because when you remove culture from language, that's just a mechanistic approach. I think they're all intertwined. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is that expectations of the encounter, for example, are affected by culture, whether they seek, don't seek, or care, what they expect from the encounter. Language is one component of expressing what they want. But some things are below the visible or the spoken language.
I won't add much, but I want us again to go back to the humanity of all this. When We've seen a lot of patients not being able to be seen by or let in clinics because they can't advocate for themselves that maybe the cough that they have is part of a chronic illness that they have. There were real consequences that affected people and even life that could have been lost because of lack of communication. So sometimes we say a lot of these words, but we want people to really understand that there is that population that are suffering, not for anything else, not because care couldn't be provided, but because there's a lack of communication that can be fixed.
Finally, something that Mr. Murillo mentioned bluntly and that both our other speakers echoed was to have a heart. Treat all your patients as a human being first and a patient second, and try your best as a physician to connect with them using the resources that are available to you.
You know, I've been thinking a lot about since starting medical school and learning about these disparities is how, as physicians, we take this oath to do no harm. And our healthcare system creates a lot of harm, a lot of good too. But I think there's something to be said for, you know, once you learn about these disparities and once you learn that these issues are really just a culmination of a lot of individuals treating people the exact same way, our society has structures in place that are not accessible to everyone, and intentionally so. We do need to be intentional about, now that we know, what can we do to move forward? What can we do to move forward?
We want to thank everyone for listening to our podcast today. We hope you learned about the importance of adequate interpretation, the necessity of further developing navigation and interpretation infrastructure, and we're reminded of the humanity of all of this. And we keep that in mind when caring for patients who don't speak English. We want to thank Dr. Giselle Corby-Smith, as well as Dr. Gabriella Harris, for their expertise in leading our class and inspiring us to keep health equity in mind as we learn medicine. We'd also really love to thank our amazing podcast guests, Mr. Murillo, Megan and Daniela from Refugee Community Partnership, and Dr. Aleman from UNC. We're so grateful for their contribution. You can find out more about COMPOS at med.unc.edu/COMPOS. And you can find out more about Refugee Community Partnership at refugeecommunitypartnership.org. We look forward to continuing this conversation over email, phone, or Zoom, and hopefully at some point in person. So please reach out to us with questions or comments. That's all for today.